Welcome, everyone, to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles and their enriching stories about lives, their victories, their failures, their ambitions, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host, and today we're exploring our non-fiction library of fascinating topics. So please enjoy. And to find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome, everybody, wonderful Goldster members, visitors, strangers, and enemies, if you're out there somewhere, because for the next hour in this Goldster early summer conversation, we are going on a journey through movie land. The silence, the talkies, the golden era, the stars, the moguls. And now what do we have? The streaming series and the 10-second TikTok bursts, all of them that impact our lives. So before I begin to introduce my guest, who is sitting so quietly and obediently beside me, she is incredible. I'll say a word. She is humble because she described herself to me when we chatted yesterday or the day before as a jobbing writer, when in truth she is the temple of knowledge of everything about films, particularly all thing about women in films. But first, please, I'm going to reverse this. I want you to contribute to this conversation. Put in the chat your favorite film of all time, the star you like, and if you have one, the directors. I discussed an arc for this Goldster Inside story with my guest, but we agreed it could go anywhere the conversation took us. So hurl it at us. Give us more than we can handle. From a childhood of devouring books, going to the cinema and film, from her first job as a box office assistant, my guest has gone on to write and contribute to books on directors like Jane Campion, The Piano and The Power of the Dog, Ang Lee, Brokeback Mountain, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, as well as working on books about Charlie Chaplin, James Bond, and chronicling the role of women behind the scenes in silent movies. You wouldn't believe this story, Silent Women. And I hope, though, my guest will not be silent. Welcome the great Ellen Cheshire, the Goldster Inside Story.
Thank you very much, Humphrey. What an introduction there. I'll do my best.
We're talking about Hollywood. I put on a pink shirt for the occasion.
You know, you just glammed up there.
Yeah. Now, who are these characters? Who's that woman in dark glasses behind you there?
So the woman in dark glasses behind me is the lovely Audrey Hepburn. There are three there, triptych of three lovely princes from her most sort of iconic role in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Oh, Breakfast. That is a wonderful movie. Totally different to the book. We did Breakfast at Tiffany's on our book club.
Okay, Truman Capote.
Yes,
he wanted Marilyn Monroe, so it would have been a very different film.
It would have been a very different film, isn't it? And talking about very different films, what is your favourite film of all time?
Well, this is, I said, one of those really the sort of toughest questions, and it's one you get asked a lot if you kind of work in the film biz. It obviously depends on the day of the week, what mood you're in, who you're talking to, because there's a certain element of sort of performative. If I say something too highbrow or too lowbrow, will people kind of be put off? So I normally sort of plump for something kind of Hollywood golden age with one of my, you know, the fabulous women that were working on screen there. So I normally go for, and I will go for that today and put it, if you haven't seen it, add it to your list. All About Eve, starring the great Betty Davis.
All About Eve, the great Betty Davis.
Your seatbelts, we're in for a bumpy ride. That line is
okay.
About a sort of aging theatrical star who has a new, younger, up-and-coming star hot on her tails.
I have just written that. And it shows that I can still write.
Marilyn Monroe in the 12th.
And we have, what do we have here? We have iPad Kathy. I like that name. That's a good movie star name, isn't it? iPad Kathy. The Horse Whisperer and anything that Robert Redford is in. Other great films Robert Redford's been in.
He has made some...
Yeah. Out of Africa.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful man in both on and off screen, because obviously he is very supportive of independent cinema and he started the Sundance Film Festival. So
yes, he did.
If you ever hear Sundance, that's all kind of the magic of Robert Redford behind the scenes.
Robert Redford. And he did, didn't he do The Way We Were with Barbara Streisand?
He did indeed, yes. I, when you said that, I went, the most beautiful man in the world. That was the image I had in my head from that film.
So Mary C., her favourite actors, Denzel Washington and Jane Fonda.
Oh, well, if I was sitting in the other direction, you would have a picture of Denzel Washington behind me. So ahead of me, I have Denzel Washington poster for Mississippi Masala, which is a really early 90s film directed by a female director, Mira Nair, who at that time I wrote my A-level essay on back, so almost 30 years ago. I was championing women directors, being pushed by my teacher to do, you know, Peter Greenaway. I went, no, I want to do a woman. There were very few to choose from. We didn't study any at my level. And I went and found Mira Nair, who I said, Denzel Washington.
And now just Jane Fonda is in Mary C's thing. Didn't she do a recent film called All Souls at Night with Robert Redford and about a very elderly two people living in a community and she knocks on his door and says, will you sleep with me? Not sleep as in sleep, but sleep as in sleep because she wanted company and it went from there. Do you know that?
I've seen that one, no, but also,
thoroughly recommend that to anybody.
I'll add that to my list. I'm always up for people's recommendations, so I will go through this chat because there's, as I said, there are lots of films out there and I haven't seen them all. I mean, I went to last night. Was given a handout of 50 films. I'd seen only 27. So the 23 British queer films I've got to find.
So we've got All About Eve with Betty Davis is yours. The Prestige. I don't know that one. The Prestige.
Christopher Nolan film. So Christopher Nolan, who has directed the sort of Batman films recently and Oppenheimer coming up later this year. Yeah. But The Prestige falls into one of my other areas of interest, which is a sort of magic and sort of circus and fun fairs and things like that. It's a lovely Victorian, really twisty, turny, sort of psychological thriller. Not sure how to describe it.
Turny,
has David Bowie in it. So that's
Alfred Hitchcock.
Yep. Well, he made a few films.
He did.
Starts in the silent period and goes, you know, right the way through the 80s. I mean, we talked about it the other day, Humphrey, about how Psycho transformed the way we go to the cinema.
Yes.
But behind him at every step of the way was his wife, Alma Revels. So if you watch the recent film Hitchcock with Helen Mirren and Anthony Hopkins, you'll see how important his wife, Alma Revel, was. And she was actually ahead of him in the industry when he first arrived inside of film studios. But he didn't ask her out until he'd progressed up the ladder. So it was of equal ranking to her within the industry. So they had to wait a few years.
So he didn't marry up.
He came up to her level. Didn't ask her out until, I think she was already an editor the studios. And he arrived as someone who designed the intertitles in silent films. So really kind of low down the rungs. It wasn't until he became an assistant director that he had the courage to ask Alma Revel out.
We're going to go right back to before 1900 in a moment. I just want to get through these because they're so good. They must. Well, we can let them throw us off track a bit. But Sue Townley, Some Like It Hot. That's Marilyn Monroe, isn't it?
And again, yes, Marilyn Monroe again for the third time. Billy Wilder directed it, who it's his birthday today. So happy birthday to Billy Wilder, who also directed...
You are an encyclopedia temple of knowledge, aren't you? Goodness gracious.
I think I just spotted it on Twitter this morning. I go, oh, maybe that means I can get to watch a Billy Wilder movie today. Which one should I watch? Some Like It Hot, The Apartments, Stalag 17, Sunset Boulevard. I mean, he made a lot of great films. Austrian, and a lot of Austrian silent films all coming to Hollywood.
Sue also is, or the early Clint Eastwood movies, the Spaghetti Westerns, possibly Where Eagles Dare, which was an Alistair MacLean film. What was Clint Eastwood's first movie, Ellen?
Oh, I don't know. The first one I remember seeing him in was something like The Creatures from the Black Lagoon or something like that, a really kind of sort of a cheesy late 50s thing where he's just like in a lab coat, which I saw in 3D at a film festival. But there's Clint Eastwood in 3D from this early. But I think alone for his westerns and his 50s sci-fi.
Well, would it be right to say that the spaghetti westerns, like Good, Bad, and the Ugly, and those, they were the ones that made his name, that catapulted into a Hollywood star?
Yes, I would have thought so. So he had done sort of a Western television show, and then goes to Italy to make these the kind of the trilogy.
Yes, he did that very. He wasn't Bonanza; it was another one, Rawhide. He did Rawhide.
No, I think he was a name, and then goes to make these films with Sergio Leone out in Italy.
Yes,
and comes back and has
a couple more. A couple more before we're going to move back to 1895, I think you said. Meryl Streep is Monique's favourite actress, but the favourite film ever, Moonstruck, starring Cher.
Cher, you know, like Nicolas Cage, yes. Lovely sort of romantic drama, really. Romantic drama with some humour. But yeah, that's no, I kind of love it.
Yes. Yeah, Sue Talent, Rowdy Yates in Rawhide.
That Thank was you very much.
Yes, thank you, Sue, for that. I knew it was worth a man.
More useful. And of my researchers to hand.
Yeah. Geeta, who loves the prestige that we just discussed, can you explain, and why not Probably explain not. It now, because you wrote about Ang Lee, can you explain the life of Pi to us, please? I saw it years ago and got a bit confused.
Okay, well, I'm not sure I can explain the life of Pi to you particularly. I mean, it is, it's a complex sort of tale where you have the framing device of this character, Pi, who is sort of telling his story of how he got from sort of India to Canada via a big shipwreck and tells of this sort of, could it be an allegory for what the story he's telling about traveling with a tiger and some kind of baboon type thing and some other animals. Was he really using that to as a cover for what really happened, which is a much darker tale of who he was traveling with?
I think we're left to kind of wonder
things as you go through. There's been the recent stage production, which they've had live broadcasts of, which was really good. So if that pops up again as a repeat in your cinema, the National Theatre Live, Life of Pi, I would recommend that as well. It was very effective.
I do remember the life of Pi was when they reached land and the tiger who he'd formed this relationship with during, the tiger just leapt off the boat and ran off, you know, no goodbyes or anything like that.
So, but yeah, so it's a sort of allegorical.
It's an allegory of our lives, I guess.
Using this to cover up something obviously much darker. But it is one to repeat. And obviously the film is slightly different to the book, which is different from the stage play as adaptations. You know, you can't slavishly translate from one art form to another because they have different
things. But the same ways. Thing. Tracy mentions here and watched The Deer Hunter last night. Great film. Goodness, that is a great film, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. I think one of those classic films that you see a lot in the clip shows, you know, you often just see the one famous scene from The Deer Hunter, which is the Russian roulette scene. And so I went into that with a very different expectation than then presented with an entirely different film. So sometimes you've seen clips and you get put off by something, or you think you've seen the entire film because you've seen so many clips or images.
Yes.
But it's always worth giving something a try. Initially puts you on.
One of our great Goldster guests that we had on about a year ago, Hilary Brown, was the... if you remember the clip from The Deer Hunter of a female American correspondent on the aircraft carrier as they're pushing off the helicopters and that from it, which was a real clip from her, because she was the first female ABC war correspondent, and they used that clip on her. She's aged now in her late 70s and just got married. So... So that's...
She sounds great.
So we are going to go back to that now. I want you to take us to the world of the cinema in around the 1890s, when I didn't even know there was such a thing as film. Tell us about that.
Yep. So we start... beginning of film, sort of moving images. They were initially called animated photographs. So there wasn't really a language for this new art form. So we'd had images that had moved before, things like magic lantern shows, kinescope parlors, like the kind of what the butler saw. So there'd always been a desire to see images move. And so various technologies are going on in the 1890s, late 1880s, 1890s, often by photographers to develop the two things you need, which is a camera to record moving images. And then you also need a projector to project those. So you had various different people working on these around the world. And sort of first out of the first to kind of launch a system to paying audiences were the Lumiere brothers in 1895, Paris, in December. So they were the first, they've been credited as the first to kind of have filmed something and projected something to a paying audience. But there were other experimenters, and Britain is right in there as part of this pioneering. If you're anywhere near Brighton, go to the Hove Museum. There's a fascinating exhibition there about all the kind of British photographers that were working in this. But Lumiere's first out, so hence that's the kind of the name that a lot of people might know as like the first filmmakers.
And the women element of that, very strong in there.
So you have Lumiere's. So they're, as in, mainly photography people, and they're making films like Lumiere workers leaving the factory, train arriving at station. So they're just filming actualities. And at this point, we've only got celluloids or nitrate film that's about 30 seconds long. So when you're going to see a film program, you're seeing a collection of lots of 30-second, possibly up to a 60-second bits of film. In the audience for that 1895 screening was Mr. Pathé, who was photography, and his secretary, Alice Guy Blanchet, who kind of went to her boss, you know, this is really interesting technology. Could I have a play with it? And he went, well, yes, but only in your spare time. You're primarily my secretary, but in your spare time, if you'd like to have a play with this technology, I will let you do that. So Alice Guy Blanchet then over her career over the next 20 or 30 years kind of made upwards of like 600 films and really started, again, remember some of these films are only like half a minute long, but she starts making slightly longer films as her career develops. She is credited as the first person to direct a kind of a fiction film. So having all these train arriving at station, it was Alice Guy Blanchet that went, hang on, let's get an actor in, let's kind of create a scenario, have costumes, sets, props, and make a fiction film. So, you know, we can credit the first fiction film in the world to Alice Guy Blanchet.
Just drive me. So this fiction film was not 90 minutes long.
This is 30 seconds.
What's the story?
It's called The Cabbage Patch Fairy. And it is about a fairy who finds little babies under cabbages in a film. So we're very primitive filmmaking. So at this point, 1895, probably through to about 1907, we're kind of in what we would call primitive filmmaking. These are people still learning the technologies. Are people interested in seeing moving images? Where are you seeing them as audiences? At this point, your main sort of popular entertainment is going to a variety show or a music hall in the UK, and where you'd see, you know, a juggling act, you'd see a singer, you'd see some performing sea lions, and then you would see 10 minutes of a collection of films, which would have no sound at this point. So that's where the orchestra would play music underneath it, or you'd have someone on the side of the stage explaining it to you. So this is kind of where you're seeing it, or in pop-up tents, in circuses and fun fairs, shop front parlours. So this is really kind of, we're just learning. They're all called different technologies. We don't have the language we have now around film.
No. And I want to ask you two totally separate questions regarding that.
Go for it.
the first one is these are 30-second long things that you were saying. How does that compare in the way we think about things? Because, you know, a Facebook video that people put up or whatever are all, you know, 30 seconds or 15 seconds or something, which is now the way that we're absorbing our information.
So
I don't even know what the question is.
The question is, we are back. As I said, TikTok is essentially all these kind of capturing reality, what's happening in 30 seconds to sort of tell a story is happening.
Yes.
So, you know, within a few years after that, so like early 1900s, you've got filmmakers that are going, hang on, let's say if I take three bits of 30 seconds and kind of edit them together, I will have 90 seconds. And these edits may not need to be all in the same place. So you may change between locations. So A Kiss in the Tunnel, which is a rather saucy Brighton set film, has a couple, a train going into a tunnel. And then in the tunnel, they use the darkness for a bit of a smooch. And then the train comes out of the other end of the tunnel. So the idea...
That's the 30 seconds and 90 seconds.
90 seconds. So we have the train. Then we have a real train, on shot on location in Brighton. Then we have clearly a set-up staged sit where the director and his wife are also the smooching couple.
Well, we don't know who the characters are. They are
the director and his wife. And then the train pops out. Then it was remade a few months later by a Yorkshire-based photographer. And The Kiss is much racier up in Yorkshire than it was down in Brighton. Remakes were happening right from the early days. And our links between trains and...
Yeah. And the second question surrounding this era that I want is that it was the ballast of this was the women that were pioneering it and making it work. Were they all wives and secretaries, or was there one that came through a professional?
So the reason why I sort of, when I heard this or my colleague heard this fact at a conference in sort of 2015, when you probably remember it, there was a lot of kind of work across all different industries to try and find the stories of women that had been written out of past histories, whether that was theatre, science, music. So film was along there. There were women. Why aren't their stories and names known as well? And at this conference, my colleague Melody, who edited had Bryony Dixon, who is the head of silent film at the BFI, say that there were more women working behind the scenes at all levels in the first 30 years of film than in the most recent 30 years. So there were more women directors working from 1895 through to the basic arrival of sound
given
in the 20s.
Then in the strata,
they kind of...
Was it all like the Pathé director who said to the secretary, it has to be a hobby, and they were all doing it as their hobbies whilst they were raising children?
Yeah, there was a certain element of that, so hobbies, experimentations, the wives of, and there were, but then some obviously came through and broke through started making a name for themselves. So the ones, a couple, if you're interested in this topic, I'll just name a couple. And their films are available on YouTube, as well as Alice Guy Blanchet, who was the French one, hundreds of films. Really fascinating one to look out from her is a film called Consequences of Feminism, which is a film where she has gender reversed the expected roles. I can't remember the exact day, but we're talking about something like 1908 or something like that. And this is
about
3 or 4 minutes. So in this film...
This is the sort of stuff we're talking about at the moment.
Yeah, this, so in this film, you know, you have the men sitting around in bars drinking and smoking cigars and patting their male partners on the bottom as they go off to look after the children. So, you know, she... that's on YouTube. Enjoy it. It won't take you long to watch. So she was doing that. She leaves France, goes to America and sets up a film studio in America. There is a fascinating documentary about Alice Guy Blanchet called Be Natural, which was her kind of mantra for filming. I think it's possibly on a streaming service.
Now, as you've been speaking, we have a mini competition going on there.
Okay.
Anna has asked a question about the artist on the cushion.
Yes.
And Monique has given us a guess, which is that it's like Frida Kahlo.
It is Frida Kahlo, right? Yes. So this is
Monique. You are the star. You are the temple of knowledge.
So there is a biopic on Frida Kahlo, which is a very very good one, also directed.
Really, are you able to lift her off the cushion and show it to us?
That's my. There you go.
Oh, okay, brilliant. So you only saw the half the face there, Monique.
This confusingly is not another Audrey Hepburn or Frida Kahlo. This is.
Let's have a look. Can you bring her over here?
One is actually Gene Simmons doing an advert for Lux Soap, who was.
That was the look of those days, was it? The Audrey Hepburn look.
Similar contemporary to Audrey Hepburn. Gene Simmons is British. Audrey Hepburn is Dutch.
Okay. And the name of the film, of the name of the role reversal film.
Is something called The Big Country, which I've not seen.
Okay.
But so they all have a similar look. In other rooms, I have, as I said, Denzel Washington opposite me.
Yes.
Just in this corner, I have quite a similar look and colour scheme.
Yeah. And I'm not sure if you said the name of the role reversal film, Gita asked.
The Consequences of Feminism. So already we're asking that question.
That's sort of like reading a Guardian op-ed at the moment, isn't it?
And it's actually quite, sort of, again, just kind of when you see a woman sort of patting a man on the bottom in a kind of way that we would have seen something like you mentioned Jane Fonda earlier, something like 9 to 5. That's obviously which talk about sort of powerful women. Jane Fonda, produced that film, so she didn't direct it. But she was certainly behind the scenes as a producer, which is obviously another key role. So some of the silent film stars like Mary Pickford then goes on to found United Artists and becomes a very important producer going through to the 50s after her film career stops. Mabel Normand, another silent film star, directed Charlie Chaplin and here's some of his first films. So there's a lot of women kind of working along there. The one I was going to mention, the other woman that you might want to look out for from this kind of period of silent film, is Lois Weber, who worked for Alice Guy Blanchet when she first worked. So she got her first hand into the industry through Alice Guy Blanchet. And then Lois Weber went on to hit a lot of firsts for women directors. Obviously, we have to sort of caveat women of, but certainly at her peak, she was talked of in the trade press of the time in the same breath as Charlie Chaplin or Cecil B. DeMille, was one of the highest paid Hollywood film directors. Universal built a studio for her. She founded the sort of motion picture production union. So she was really embedded. She directed dozens of shorts and full-length films. One of hers to look out for, it's on YouTube, is called Suspense. I mean, it really is
Suspense.
Well, Suspense, yeah. Again, it's another short. So at this time, when we talk about shorts, or you may hear the term one reeler, that's because a reel of film at this time was about 12 minutes.
Well,
up to 12 minutes, then a two-reeler would be 20 minutes. Yeah. A six-reeler would be a really long time.
And Sue Townley has asked, we're going to get to it in a moment, Sue, about the format of B-movies and two-movies and all that sort of thing, which you sort of touched on there. But before we go to that, you mentioned Charlie Chaplin, Louis Weber a few times. So, and you mentioned up to sort of, I think we were at 1907... 1914, yes. Charlie Chaplin arrives in Hollywood. Who is he? Why was he so successful? He ended up being a multimillionaire owning his own studio, didn't he? He wasn't just the guy with the bowler hat and the...
Ties back in together. So from 1907, you start getting longer films. So these could be half an hour. And then by the early teens, you start getting really long films. So by 1914, you still have really long films. Things like Intolerance or Birth of a Nation, controversially, there. That's directed by D.W. Griffith, whose name we'll come back to in a minute. So he was directing these really big epics, but you are, and he was also still directing these short films. So at the time when you were going to the cinema, this is where Chaplin comes back in, you'd be there for hours. So because you didn't have your television, you didn't have your other mediums. So when you went to the cinema, you could potentially have a 3 or 4 hour program, not just a 3 or 4 hour film that we get now. You'd have a lot of different things within that 4 hours. You'd have a newsreel, you'd have cartoons, you'd have serials. So like a sort of 20 minutes, you know, she's left, you know, tied to the railway tracks. Will someone come and rescue you? Literally those cliffhangers. You might have had some music, little shorts of stars of the day. You might have even, if you went to a really posh cinema, had live music. Then you might have had your B movie, which was this a bit later, you know, an hour and 10 minutes, and then a feature film, which is like an hour and a half, hour and 40 minutes. So you were there for ages. You could turn up at any time. So you didn't have to just turn up at 8 o'clock when the film started. You could turn up at 20 past eight and sit round and watch it all again. So this is happening, again, this is predominantly in America and UK. So different worlds, countries had different practices. And that comes to an end in 1960 with Alfred Hitchcock and Psycho, because he said, I only want people to turn up at the beginning of the film and then leave at the end. And that sort of comes to a bit of that. Even when I was going to the cinema in the 70s in Muswell Hill, the Odeon, we would often have a short before the main feature, but it was sort of dying out a bit. But then cinema in general was kind of dying out a bit in the 70s.
So Sue Townley's era of what happened to the B movies, you always got two movies when I was a child. That was that era, I guess, you went in and you got your A side and B side of that, plus the Pathé newsreel.
Pathé newsreels and the newsreels, So if you're kind of watching films now from that kind of, we'll stick with the golden age of Hollywood, which is sort of 1930s with the arrival of sound through to the kind of late 50s, early mid-60s, you can see by the length, the B feature would be roughly about an hour and 10 minutes, and then your main feature would be an hour and 40. So there's quite a lot of those B movies that are like on YouTube or Internet Archive, where you could just watch these kind of sort of much more lower budget, cheap and cheerful, often sort of crime films.
I want to go back to Charles Chaplin in a second and then move on, but we are being...
our audience.
which artist did your Audrey Hepburn pictures? Because that artist to paint her.
I'm afraid I would love to be able to say to you, and that actually this is where, I mean, as a prior to, you know, a few years ago before we were doing everything online, probably about four people have seen them in my home office, and now hundreds of thousands have seen them. They were a present from my brother. He went to Germany to get them. He'd seen something online and went out to Germany just to get them. I wrote a book on Audrey Hepburn, and that was my little present for my baby brother.
And Keita, following up, because it was a good. Which quiz did you do when you scored 27?
Oh, so it was a quiz. No, so last night I went to a talk on the history of British queer cinema at my local cinema in Chichester. And they gave out a handout of 50 films they recommended, and I'd only seen 27. So that's 23 British queer cinema films I've got to watch over the time.
Yeah. Jennifer brings us back to Charlie Chaplin. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you. Keep us on track.
But Tracy's asked a question that I'm going to bring in later because it's actually about pivotal films changing genre. Okay. Charlie Chaplin was brought up in absolute poverty. His father left when he was very...
Monique, in your question, it was New Park Cinema. I do talks there, so if you're ever in Chichester, I do live in-person talks at New Park.
Tell us, brought up in poverty, mother with mental health problems, himself begging when he was a child, ends up as a studio producer and global star in Hollywood with his bowler hat and his walking stick.
His dad is both his parents are music hall performers. So he's kind of growing up in, I suppose, you know, what we think of like sort of 1880s, 1890s, real kind of poverty, in and out of the workhouse in Kennington, which is now the Cinema Museum in Kennington. So do pop that on your places to visit list. Basically his dad gets him a gig aged eight in eight or nine, in a show called Eight Lancashire Lads, which is a clog dancing act, and then basically he's on stage for the rest of his working life. So he does really well within the musical, rises up the ranks, and it's when he's with a troupe called Carno where he has developed this tramp character that he's spotted by Max Sennett of the Keystone Studios, who invites him out with a very attractive contract to make films. And in his first year in Hollywood, which was 1914, I think he made something like 40 plus shorts. So these are these 20-minute films. So he starts off being directed by Mabel Normand, who he also is starring opposite a lot because Max Sennett and Mabel Normand were a couple. You may have seen the musical Mac and Mabel around and about. It often pops up, which is about their life. So by the end of his first year in Hollywood, he is just a global sensation. I mean, it's hard to describe how big he got so quickly in Hollywood. So there was articles being written called Chaplinitis, where the whole world had got Chaplinitis. And they were working out how many people around the world had seen his films, which were in one day, they reckoned like a billion plus people seeing his films around the world each day. So an absolutely massive star, which basically allowed him to get bigger contracts with other studios. But eventually he ends up joining forces with D.W. Griffith of those very long worthy films, Mary Pickford and her husband. The name has escaped me for a second. It'll pop back into my head. And they found United Artists.
So Charlie Chaplin, the of United Artists,
along with Mary Pickford and D.W. Griffith. And he's very famous. And I'm really embarrassed that I can't remember his name. So Douglas Fairbanks, thank you very much. Helping me out.
You joined the Temple of Knowledge with all
the... Thank you very much. Yeah. So they basically form United Artists, where they are producing and distributing their own films and therefore getting in the money from the distributing, i.e. the cinema circuit, as opposed to going to another studio.
Now, who owns United Artists now?
So over the years, in the Hollywood golden age, as we've kind of all those Hollywood studio system. So once sound comes in at the sort of towards the end of the 1920s, there's a real sort of major kind of shift in Hollywood film production as you've having to take on sound. It soon became, it wasn't just a fad. And this was a real turning point. So a number of the smaller studios, people who couldn't invest in the new technology of recording with sound go away, or they're bought up by some of the biggest studios. So there's a real kind of power grab. Actors that are too expensive or too problematic are dumped. Then new actors are brought in that have lovely speaking voices, where you get a whole incoming load of British actors to the Hollywood studio systems, all coming from the stage, who previously would have sort of dismissed, you know, why would I as a stage actor with this wonderful voice want to be in silent films? So you have a real kind of changing of the guard in the late 20s and early 30s. And there you get your established kind of top five studios that come into place, the names of which you will still recognize now, things like MGM, Warner Brothers, United Artists, Universal, Columbia Pictures. So all these names we still see at the beginning of films, yeah, but obviously they're completely different. Yeah.
And that was when the one I got pushed out.
Small print, they're now owned by, you know, companies that own, you know, Coca-Cola.
And that was when
the film studio. So very different than these kind of mogul days where they were being driven by these kind of single men and they're sort of driving through. And it was really the producers, yeah, during the whole golden age of Hollywood that held the power, not the directors or the stars.
Yeah, and that was when the women... So the women was diminished.
Yeah. So only in Hollywood, only two directors that had women directors who had been directing in silent films made the transition to sound. One had a slightly more elevated career, Dorothy Arzner, who was was a lesbian director at the time. And if you've seen the film Babylon recently, the Damien Chazelle character, the director, the female director in that is kind of very loosely based on Dorothy Arzner, and the Margot Robbie character on Clara Bow. They did collaborate together in Clara Bow and Dorothy Arzner, but it really is not based on them at all. Loosely based on. And the other one was Dorothy Davenport, who went to what was called the Poverty Row Studios that were churning out those serials and the B features. But again, both of them probably didn't last beyond a kind of late there. So then you don't get a woman film director in Hollywood again until Ida Lupino, who is a British actor who went to Hollywood and then starts her own production company. And that's later in the 50s. So you don't get any for about 20 years. And then after Ida Lupino, you don't get another kind of real woman director in Hollywood for another 20 years till the kind of late.
You mentioned that there was a technological change in the coming in of sound, and it created a change of a lot of things. And then you mentioned Hitchcock coming in with a sort of editorial change. Trace has got a question here. Talking of the 70s, did Star Wars regenerate interest in cinema? Can I expand that and say, what are the pivotal films like Star Wars that makes us think differently about cinema? What we want to watch changes the market?
So in terms of the ways in which you can study films are so varied. I write for the A-level film textbook, so I'm quite up on like the A-level film syllabus, which I think is quite an interesting place to think about, because these are potentially our future filmmakers or film critics or film historians, film lecturers. What are they being asked to study at college, age 16, 17 and 18? Like I said, when I was doing it in the early 90s, the feminist film that we had was directed by a man. So, even though there were direct films directed by women coming out in that time, Jane Campion had her first few films a couple of years ago. It hadn't made it onto the syllabus. So I think it's very interesting to think about how the syllabus is written, as that's in this country a grounding point. There are far more women on the syllabus now. But one of the things I do ask you to think about is the sort of what was happening technology-wise, or what's happening in the kind of industry or in the culture around when that film's being made that made that film as it was. So technological points are really important. So just a really brief run through. So you have the arrival of sound in the late 1920s, by the kind of beginning of the 30s, other than Chaplin. No one else is really making silent films anymore. Hitchcock was partway through directing, or had pretty much finished, a film called Blackmail. And when sound came, he went, right, I'm remaking this as a sound film. So there's Blackmail. Hitchcock's film is both as a silent and a sound film. So you have this pivotal moment, obviously, depending on the clout of the director, whether they could do things like that for Hitchcock. Others would have just been then either cut down and put out as B features or dumped altogether, or they may have had a go at trying to add in some extra scenes in sound or add in sort of sound effects. So that's that period. So then we kind of trundle along, kind of pretty much making films in a sort of fairly traditional way with sound and cameras, quite heavyweight cameras, until probably the sort of post-war period. So although cameras were still heavy, in places in Europe, there was far more of a culture of not bothering to capture sound whilst you're on location, because if you're having to capture sound as well, you've got a lot more things to work with. So in Europe, there's a lot more of a history of post-syncing the sound on afterwards. So the sort of Italian neorealist films are kind of filming out on location. So suddenly moving away from studios and out on location is something that's quite appealing. So that comes from Europe first, and then Hollywood kind of think about trying to see if they can get more freedom.
I've just looked at the clock, so okay. I'm going to fire you with specific things on this as we go forward. James Bond, Did that change filmmaking at all or film thinking?
Yeah. So again, there's a really interesting way of thinking about James Bond, thinking about that as through the history of British cinema. At my local university at Chichester, they have a module, which is an introduction module for students, kind of introducing you to a lot of concepts by just examining James Bond films. Because through that, you get a lot of changes in technology, changes in filmmaking, representation of women and men, sort of gender, a lot of the sort of theories behind films.
So he's changed the character, hasn't he?
Changed as a character, it's changed technology. And obviously, again, more recently, a very powerful woman behind there, Barbara Broccoli, the daughter of Cubby. So again, since she got more involved, you probably have a little less of the sort of Dr. Warm Flash punning names, and you know, women can be a little bit more like M, the Judy Dench M. They can actually be the secretaries.
Another fight. Jane Campion. Tell us about Jane Campion.
So Jane Campion, as I said, was one of those few directors that was at work when I was doing my A-level, but didn't study her there. Did when I went to university a few years later. But I wrote the first book in the world on Jane Campion. So that's my big first credit. Back in the early 2000s, I pitched a book on Jane Campion. It was a new publishing house, and I was only one of two women that they were asking to submit titles on. And so I threw my hat into the ring with various titles, and they went with Jane Campion first. So I was really pleased. Later, I wrote Ang Lee, Audrey Hepburn, and co-wrote the Coen Brothers for them. But then
you're not allowed to rush through all those.
Oh, okay. So,
Jane Campion, the piano, very slow.
Jane Campion, most people probably would be aware of the piano. They may be shocked to realize that is now 30 years old. Sorry about that. I've just taken 10 years out of your timeline. Now, even though I have to double check.
That's right.
I often get like, 20 years ago, and someone puts in the chat, no, that's 30 years ago, Ellen.
Yeah.
So
what was amazing about it? In terms of
exploration around female sexuality, first of all, having a film of that scale directed by a woman at that time was quite rare. She had made a few films before, one feature film and one television series, Angel at My Table. And I think what's lovely about it is it's a really, really cruel, dark sort of, although it is a romantic question mark, you know, it's not, sort of playing to kind of traditional expectations about what a woman director and a woman in this situation, you know, that the main character, she's a really, really quite, you know, a sort of cruel, stroppy, you know, but, you know, has this incredible sexuality and tension, obviously plays into my love of the Gothic as well. And that was really rare to see something of that scale. And then even though it was quite a small film, it got picked up by a distributor that really pushed it through to worldwide attention and Oscar success.
Ang Lee, the other director that you studied, totally different.
So Jane Campion has been quite consistent with the kind of films that she's been interested in until The Power of the Dog. I have to rewrite the book because most of her films are around women, troubled women repressed in their sort of artistic pursuits and so forth. So there's quite a strong thread of similarity in the material that Jane Campion chooses. Ang Lee, all over the place. I mean, you know, every
it's
film.
A good way, though.
So, you know, his first three films were made in Taiwan. He's a Taiwanese director, although he was already living, had studied in America at this point, couldn't get funding to make a film in the English language, so applied for competitions out there. But if you go through his list of films, you'd go, sorry, did one person direct all of those? You know, because he does these three Taiwanese films. Then he does The Sense and Sensibility, the one with Kate Winslet, Hugh Grant, and Greg Wise. Then he makes The Ice Storm, which is a really kind of intimate, you know, sort of 70s set American drama. Then Rise of the Devil, a big American Civil War. Then Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which I just saw someone's popped up there. Love that. You know, that was only cost $10 million to make. So, you know, even then that was a small budget for something of that scale. But again, introduced a whole new genre and way of, I mean, obviously it had been established out in China before. It was a popular artistic form out there, but bringing that to the UK. Hulk, you know, his Marvel film, which was, you know, far more art house than I think many at that time Marvel fans were expecting. Like Brokeback Mountain, Lust Caution, you know, 18 certificate, yeah. Really, you know, sort of sex erotic thriller. Life of Pi, someone mentioned. And then in the last couple of films, he's been really experimenting with technology that has alienated both critics and audiences, but are really interesting ways in which to tell stories using new technology, which is what we were sort of talking on about, how technology has shaped the way in which we see films. So again, there was a pocket of, you know, when...
Well, I think that's the case, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, so when cameras became more lightweight, yeah. When we introduced digital technology, yeah. When digital editing comes in, and now we've got the majority of our films being shot digitally rather than on 35mm films. We have some directors that are still, I'm only shooting on 35mm film. So the Prestige, Christopher Nolan, he's still only shooting on film. So technology is all the way through really dictating both and the way in which film
technology
and scene.
Yeah, changes sort of the genre. Now, Geeta's got a series of questions for you. which we're going to do as we begin to wrap up.
Okay.
Your favorite film as a child?
My favorite film. So I grew up in the UK in the 70s. Was my coming of age. We only really had three channels to begin with. So there was those afternoon double bills, if you remember, on a Sunday afternoon. So I would sit down and watch those classic movies, which is how I fell in love with people like Bette Davis, Joan Crawford, Gregory Peck, all those wonderful stars of the yesteryear. So I still have my great love of those. And then we were quite early in getting a video recorder. So again, this is about technology. So
we have to get you down to be more specific.
Okay. So
the name of your favorite film.
I'm getting there. So when I was about 13, I'm going to go for 13. So I'm beginning to get a sense of myself as a person of interesting, you know, interested in things. We had about 8 videotapes, one of which was Singing in the Rain. Which is probably the greatest musical of all time, probably the greatest film about Hollywood of all time, and is about this whole transition from silent to sound. So I didn't know when I was 13 that I'd end up writing about the transition from silent to sound, but certainly I would imagine that was planted a seed in my head.
Singing in the Rain.
Singing in the Rain. So I unfortunately broke my leg when I was about 13, and I probably watched it about 40 times when I was...
I think you've given us your favourite actor and actress in that period, but who is your favourite actor and actress now?
So the directors, actors I would probably go out and see kind of pretty much whatever they were in would be people like Kate Blanchett, you know, on the sort of the female side. On the male side, I think one of the most sort of intriguing actors now is Oscar Isaacs, who I saw sort of first because of my love of Coen's in Inside Llewyn Davis there. It's also in a very good... film about it's in lots of good films, but yeah, I think he's one to watch out for.
And
Cillian Murphy in those eyes. I'm looking forward to pulling in with those.
And Geeta, I can answer your next question because you missed the beginning. Do you now have a favourite film? Is All About Eve?
All About Eve is the one I plumped for today. going back to my love of those classic films, and again, as a kind of theatre set. So I do really like films set within the showbiz world as well, is one of my areas of interest.
And before we go to what is coming up next, your favourite genre?
My favourite genre? That's different than my... well, if I'm not allowed things like movies set within movies or theatre worlds and circuses and things like that, that's not really a genre. Probably film noir or gothic. Gothic melodrama. Obviously, there's some parallels there. I did
so, like The Third Man is
third
film
man
one.
Being there. Yeah, so I did my MA in Gothic studies. I do have an interest in obviously a literary adaptation.
And Hitchcock is noir, is he?
Hitchcock would be noir. Yeah, the dark sides. I mean, German Expressionism, which becomes film noir. So, in terms of going back to silent films, German Expressionism.
Okay.
Everything links together. I'm going to stop talking now.
No, we want you to keep talking. Keep talking. No, don't be silent. But I have to tell people what's coming next. There seem to be a lot of people loving Brokeback Mountain, incidentally. Yeah. So I think that was
one
of his. Thursday, June 29th. That is next week. Lucinda is with Felice Hardy and her book, The Tennis Champion Who Escaped the Nazis. Felice's grandmother, Liesel Herbst, was the 1930 tennis champion of Austria. And later beat Tin Henman's grandmother at Wimbledon. That's an uplifting story. Many chilling twists in that one. And then June 30th, Lucinda hosts Book of the Month, Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, published in 1925. And that is a story that takes place in one summery June day in London, a bit like we're getting now. Tuesday, July 4th, I'm with the author, blogger, and life coach, Sarah Rayner. This is a Goldster purpose, passion, and grit conversation about dealing with mental health and how we get through life's biggest struggles. Sarah is the best-selling series, Making Friends with Anxiety, Depression, Divorce, End of Life, and all of that. So that is going to be a very gripping conversation that we're having there. July 6th. I'm with Essie Fox, a Victorian Gothic novelist. We talk about Gothic stuff. The Fascination, based in Victorian country fairgrounds, the glamour of London theatres and Oxford Street Museum, full of morbid curiosities. Goodness.
Essie Fox. July
the 7th.
She's written one about dying of films as well in Sussex.
Oh, is it really? You know Essie Fox, do you?
Yeah. Oh.
Lucinda's with Mike Gale. He's an uplifting relationships and romance, and his latest one is A Song of Me and You. Well, that does sound touching. And now this is for everybody out there. I host Book of the Month at the end of August, August 25th. Last time we had a choice between Richard Osman's The Bullet That Missed and Franz Kafka's Metamorphoses. And Kafka won that one. We have the runner-up, Richard Osman's The Bullet That Missed in this one, against Joseph Conrad's The Heart of Darkness. Put in the chat what you want over the next few weeks, and we will pick one of those and discuss it on August the 25th for our freewheeling non-recorded conversation where we can say what we want. Ellen, which one would you take out of those two?
Hearts of Darkness is, it's a bit mean to put him up against that. So I would have to say Hearts of Darkness, which I did do for my MA in Gothic studies. I can't cheat. It's not really a great film. There's a directly on that, but Apocalypse Now is very, obviously draws a lot from Hearts of Darkness.
Apocalypse Now came from Heart of Darkness, didn't it?
Yeah,
yes.
Indeed. So yeah, you can do a bit of film work there. And with your Mrs. Dalloway, the Meryl Streep fan probably already has read it, seen it, but The Hours is obviously closely parallels the Mrs. Dalloway.
Yes, so yes, that's one. So we had Michael Davis on yesterday. He faffed around a bit, but we plumped for Richard Osman's The Bullet That Missed on this one. So we're plumping you, our other guest, for Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And Anne says...
Summer read. The other one might be better for a summer read. Lighter read.
Says Heart of Darkness. Thank you. Thank you, Anne. Sue Tanley, thank you for a super session. Thank you for such an enjoyable session, but you are not off the hook yet.
No, because another testing question is there.
We have Goldster is about life and, living after 50. And the cinema is all about wanting things, overcoming obstacles, challenges, successes and failures. What tips do you have for Goldster, I was going to say, but let's... What is the most uplifting movie of all times if you feel blue and can't get out of bed in the morning?
Oh. Well, I do have my fullbacks. Obviously, I'm not going to say Singing in the Rain again because that would be...
No, you can't do that.
But I'm going to go for another Hollywood kind of film within a film. And my other kind of fullback film, if I could tell you, like my wisdom tooth removed kind of film, is Notting Hill with Julia Roberts.
Notting Hill.
And
yes.
France. And I think yes. I really like that because all their friends are really well-rounded as well. You know, it's not just about them.
Love Actually, do you like that one too?
Not so much, but...
Not so much, okay.
Yeah, Notting Hill.
My uplifting film that I'd say to anybody that's getting depressed and blue, I say, go and see Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
Especially the one with Cher where she gets out of the helicopter at the end.
Yeah.
What do you reckon of those?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love the fact that Meryl Streep, Cher is playing Meryl Streep's mother. That's great. Seeing as though they played best friends together in Silkwood all those years earlier. But
yes,
no, that her arrival is probably one of the best arrivals in films.
Isn't it? That's it. Time's winged chariot is upon us. And goodness, didn't I? We all love this Golster conversation. The thank yous and fascinatings are all coming in. That's really, really great. And thank you for all your films, comments, questions, and pushing Ellen on what her favorite this and that is. Until next week with Lucinda and Felice Hardy. Stay active, stay curious, stay conversational. Go to the movies and watch the films. And of course, stay Golster. Better still, persuade your friends, family, and enemies to come and join us. Thank you, the great Ellen Cheshire, for a truly fantastic show. And bye, bye, Ellen. Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.golster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Golster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Golster.